Testing, one, two, three. Testing, one, two, three.
Stop our prayer and then we'll have a pledge of allegiance. Father, we thank you for the privilege we have to conduct government in this city. I pray that wisdom and would guide our steps tonight and that each one of us would go home refreshed and encouraged by the proceedings. In your name we pray, amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. You may be seated. We have several council members sick tonight. First one, Mark Snyder, called in. He's a little bit under the weather. This time I'd entertain a motion to excuse Mark Snyder from tonight's meeting.
I'll make that motion.
One second.
Motion's been made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. In addition, we got a call about Ken Johnson. Our Mayor Pro Tem is under the weather, and so I would entertain a motion at this time to excuse Ken Johnson from tonight's proceedings.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Moving on to item 1.4, citizen input. Is there any citizen here tonight who would like to address the Othello City Council? If so, please raise your hand and I'll recognize you, and you can step to the microphone and leave your name and address, and you'll have 5 minutes to address the council on any topic you like. Hearing none, we'll move on to item 2, approval of agenda. At this time, I'd entertain a motion to approve tonight's agenda.
Okay. I'll second.
Motion made by Eugene and seconded by Gina. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 3, consent agenda. At this time, I'd entertain a motion to approve tonight's consent agenda.
Make that motion.
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We're moving on to item 4.1 in our current business for tonight. This time, I'd like to ask Spencer Williams, the Othello City Finance Officer, to please meet me in the front. Say a few words, and then I'm going to present Spencer with a plaque. This is to notify you that the City of Othello's 2014 budget has earned the Washington Finance Officers Association Distinguished Budget Award. This award is patterned after the Government Financial Officers Program and is the highest form of recognition in fiscal planning and budgeting within the state of Washington. The budget document is judged on meeting program criteria covering policies, operations, financial planning, and communications. In order to earn this award, the budget documents are critiqued by no less than two reviewers who have rated the document as meeting or exceeding a proficiency level. Your document has met all of the criteria for the award. I want to congratulate you, Spencer, on a job very well done for the City of Othello. Thank you. Yeah, I was supposed to look that way, I guess, right?
Let me just my Cool.
Great. Thank you, Spencer. Again, good job. The next item on our agenda, 4.2, Columbia Basin Development League. We are privileged again for the second time this year to have Mike Schweezel, the Director of Governmental Relations of the Columbia Basin Development League. I understand he's fresh on a trip over from Olympia to Othello tonight to offer us a presentation about the activities of the Columbia Basin Development League and give us an update. So, Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Yes, over from Olympia, although, you know, I'm a regular traveler to Othello. I've been coming to the monthly board meeting of the East Columbia Basin Irrigation District, which is just a couple blocks up the street, every month of this year because we're engaged in some really exciting activities and events moving our overall project forward. And the best way to stay informed about what's happening is to show up at public meetings, just like your city council meeting here, to see what public elected officials are deciding about issues that affect all of our future down the line. Want to thank the Othello City Council for its continued support of the Columbia Basin Development League. You've been members of the league for a while now, supporting our activities. As you know, the Development League was organized in the mid-1960s, and its goal in life is to pursue continued and full development of the Columbia Basin Project. We look after the resources that are available here in the region and continue to promote the development of the project. One of the things that is remarkable about the infrastructure that we have out here is the value that it adds to the economy in Central Washington. Water really is the driver for the economy, and the Columbia Basin Project is the engine that drives this infrastructure. Here's some numbers that I pulled out of the 2012 Census of Agriculture, and this is a fairly fresh document that's been published by USDA that really focuses on the amazing impact that adding water has on economic development in the economy in Central Washington. And these are three counties that are contiguous right here in Central Washington, Lincoln, Adams, and Grant County. And you'll see that all three have about the same number of acres in land and farms, about a million, give or take a little bit. You see the size of the farms, you know, Adams County, Lincoln County are have large sections devoted to dry land farming. And so the farms really have to be pretty large in order to be economic. And then you have Grant County, where the average size farm is 621,000 acres. But the last number is the one that is really significant here. This is the farm gate value of annual production, 2012, of crops grown in these counties. Same land base producing these crops. Lincoln County, $183 million, primarily monoculture dryland wheat, a few other crops grown, but primarily dryland, summer fallow rotation, small grains. Adams County, where we are here, you know, we're in the panhandle portion of Adams County. We're in the irrigated section of Adams County, and so you can see what adding some water does. You go out to the part of the county that I'm from. I'm a Ritzville native. That's dryland wheat country. It looks a lot like Lincoln County, and the farms are big out there. You get here in the Columbia Basin portion of the county, the farms get smaller, the value of production increases, $430 million. Grant County is the number one county in the state of Washington in the value of agricultural products produced, $1,762,000,000 a year, farm gate value. You add the water, you get the economic engine that drives the economy in the state. The Columbia Basin Development League has been working for a number of years now, and I started working with the Development League in 2005. I've been in the government relations business, the lobbying business, for a long time, since 1976, starting out with the Wheat Growers Association, and I worked with the Horticultural Association. I spent a dozen years as Deputy Director of the Department of Agriculture, and since 1993, I have worked with irrigation districts. Water and agriculture in the state of Washington has really been the thing that I've worked on. In 2005, the Development League asked me to join with them to work on addressing the declining aquifer in the Odessa groundwater area. And so we undertook, the Development League undertook that project, and we really got going in 2005 on this particular project. That's been the singular focus for the Columbia Basin Development League for the last number of years. One of the things we're really starting to recognize now, though, is that we also need to pay much more attention to the part of the project that is already there, the 686,000 acres that are already irrigated by the Columbia Basin Project, because we need to maintain the existing infrastructure. These projects don't run themselves, they don't stay new forever, and unless you reinvest in that infrastructure, it's not going to be around to take care of the economy in the future. So putting the Odessa sub-area special study together, how did we really get from point A to point B on this? Going back to 2001, so it's been over a dozen years ago, the Locke administration sought to enhance water supply availability in central Washington. They began what Governor Locke called his Columbia River Initiative. And it was an effort to have the National Academy of Science do a study on how much water would be available for future withdrawal from the Columbia River. He was looking for a kind of the scientific bright line that would say, gee, we can take another million acre feet of water out of the Columbia River and not hurt the salmon, and everyone will go on our merry way, and we will grow the economy in central Washington. Well, he didn't get the bright line answer. The National Academy of Science says, well, most of the year there's plenty of water in the Columbia River, but in July and August, we're bumping up against the limit. We don't know if you can safely take that water out of the river at that point in time without harming the salmon. Well, we all know, if you're in the irrigation business, July and August are fairly important months. And so that wasn't the answer we were looking for. The Locke administration came to reclamation and the three Columbia Basin Project irrigation districts in 2003 and said, hey, you guys have the largest single water right in the state of Washington, the water right for the Columbia Basin Project, and we know you're not using it at all. Can we have a conversation about maybe sharing some? And the project irrigation districts in reclamation, you know, they wanted to be good neighbors. They had interests that they wanted to pursue themselves. And so they began a conversation, and that conversation was culminated in December of 2004 with a memorandum of understanding that was signed by Governor Locke and Bill McDonald, who was the Reclamation Regional Director at that point in time and the President of the three Columbia Basin Irrigation Districts. And it set out a suite of activities that the partners would undertake together. Looking at water supply, there was a water package in this project that had some new water availability for on the project, as well as 25,000 acre feet of water that would go to Department of Ecology so they could start issuing water rights against the backlog that they had for municipal industrial water supplies off the project. And that's already come to fruition, and those water rights are almost all issued as of now. One of the key elements of that MOU was an agreement amongst the partners to begin looking at the declining aquifer in the Odessa subarea. Starting in the fall of 2003, the Development League had a series of workshops and really started to focus attention on the fact that we had 100,000 acres of highly productive irrigated agriculture in the eastern side of the project service area that wasn't currently being served by project water supplies, that was starting to kind of blink out. Wells were going dry, farmers were having to drill the wells deeper, and it became apparent that this was an area where the aquifer was being mined. There's no surface recharge, and if we didn't take action at some point in time in the near future, that 100,000 acres that was a significant part of the production base, the raw material base that drove all the processing plants, that created all the jobs, would just simply go away. It would wither on the vine, if you will. And not only would those irrigated acres be lost, but all the communities in this region that are served by the same aquifer, Othello. I know Othello's had some problems with its wells. Moses Lake has had problems with its wells. Lynn and Warden. You don't have to be a city in this region without understanding what the impacts of a declining aquifer are. So the partners decided to get it started. We went back to Washington, D.C. Doc Hastings kicked in the money to get the study started. Governor Gregoire, or Governor Locke, before he left office in December of 2004, proposed a $16 million capital budget that would begin to implement these particular actions. Governor Gregoire jumped right on board. She came in January. She had one look at this. And given her past history as the director of the Department of Ecology, she understood water. And she says, yeah, we need to move forward with this. And we got that budget passed in 2005, and the Odessa Sub-Area Special Study was begun. It's a reclamation study. It's a project continuation study. We didn't need to get new authorities from Congress to do this. We already have an authorized project. We just needed to follow the steps. It's a very highly structured, stepwise process. You check a box, you get to go on to the next box. You check that box, you get to go on. You don't get out of line when you're working with a reclamation study. The partner was Department of Ecology. Reclamation requires a 50% cost share partner to do a study like this. In 2006, the legislature passed the Columbia River Water Management Act. A lot of people believe that the successes we had in getting the Odessa Special Study Program started in that capital budget in 2005 really paved the way for passage of the Columbia River Water Management Act. That act included a $200 million bond authorization, and those dollars have been put to work over the last five biennium. In fact, next biennium, 2015-2017 biennium, we'll see the final expenditures on the first $200 million for water projects all over eastern Washington, the Columbia River Basin. It took us 7 years to complete the EIS in this study. It's complex. You know, if you want to see instant gratification and immediate action, don't get engaged in a Bureau of Reclamation environmental impact study. There's no way that they go fast. They take forever. And if you're out there trying to encourage landowners and others to stay engaged, sometimes it was pretty challenging. But we finally got it studied, got the study completed in 2012. Bureau of Reclamation holds the water rights for this project, which means that any new water that comes out of the Columbia River for this project is subject to Endangered Species Act Section 7 consultations. We completed that, and the final record of decision was issued in 2013. So what is the Odessa Groundwater Replacement Program? Well, the ARGWARP, this is something that the East District came up with. I was hoping for a kind of a snappier acronym, ARGWARP, but I'll take what I can get if I'm going to get some new water. Is the Groundwater Replacement Program, and really this is the implementation phase of the study. So when you do an EIS in the study, you come up with a hypothetical plan, a preferred alternative that they identify in the study, and they go through and you study all the environmental impacts. When you're done then, and you get the approval, get the go-ahead, then you actually get to build something, and that's what ARGWARP is. But you have to remember, in this project, it's all about the water. And while the Columbia Basin project has a water right for 6.4 million acre feet, and this water is the water storage behind Grand Coulee Dam in Lake Roosevelt, you still have to have permits from the state of Washington to actually pull it out of the river. Currently, the project has about 3.1 million acre feet in active secondary use permits, and that's the permit it takes to bring the water out of the river. For this particular program, the Odessa Sub-Area Study, the ARGWARP program, we currently have in place, and this has been done over the last several years, enough water in active permits that are in hand. Reclamation has them in hand for 87,700 acres. When you look at the amount of land that's currently irrigated in the program, this would be about a 12% increase in lands served by Columbia Basin Project water. We're not going to see new irrigation expansion here. This is about preserving a resource that's currently in play and keeping it from disappearing. But the effect is permanent firm water supply for another 87,000 acres, a 12% increase in land served by the project. So we've had a lot of milestones. I mean, you work on this thing, we go back to Washington, D.C. every year and walk the halls back there and do the same thing here in Olympia. And we've had a lot of milestones. We completed the EIS. The EIS itself, over that 7 years, cost $13.6 million. So we had to get appropriations consistently from the state legislature and from Congress. Early in Congress, it was pretty easy because it was still in the era of earmarks. And we had a couple of champions. We had Doc Hastings here in the 4th Congressional District, and we had Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, who were both really, really supportive and helpful in this, particularly in Congress. You know, you have to work on both sides, and you know, it was good having them both back there. We've gotten secondary use permits. We happened to be in the right place at the right time when the federal government did the stimulus program, the ARRA. And as a result, Reclamation was able to get funded the Weber Cooley siphons. There's actually two siphons that carry East Slough Canal beneath Interstate 90. It's about 12 miles east of Moses Lake there, $36 million. And what it does is it moves the bottleneck in the canal, where it narrows down from full capacity to partial size from the north side of the freeway to the south side of the freeway. The siphons are the bottlenecks in the system. We built the pothole supplemental feed route to improve water supply to South District. We've gotten $14 million in coordinated conservation plan. And what that is piping and lining projects in the three Columbia Basin districts. And when the three districts can be more efficient with their water use, it frees up more water supply that they can use someplace else. And that water supply from that program goes to serving lands in the Odessa sub-area. 7,700 acres of lands now get water because of piping and lining projects. And then in 2013, we hit the big one, $31.7 million capital budget appropriation for implementation of the Odessa program. $26 million of that came to East Columbia Basin Irrigation District here in Othello. Along with that then, we got the big secondary use permit, enough water for 70,000 acres. And right now, East District and Bureau of Reclamation are in the process of finalizing contracts. All the water that's delivered to farms in this project is done on the basis of a contract. East District, representing the landowners, has to have a contract that represents all the acreage, all the water, all the lands with Reclamation in order to do business. So who's all involved and what do they do? So we have East District, one of three irrigation districts that operate the Columbia Basin Project in partnership with the Bureau of Reclamation. East District is the interface with the individual landowners. They do the contracting with the landowners. They are going to design, build, and operate the delivery systems for this project. Reclamation, they're the contracting agent, they're the water right holder, they operate the major delivery systems, Grand Coulee Dam, the Keys Pumping Station, Banks Lake, Potholes Reservoir, all the reserve works. Department of Ecology is the administrator of the water law in the state, and they're the funder, they're the deep pockets, they're our folks we like to do business with. And then the landowners, they're the ones that ultimately have to decide to accept this water once it's made available. And the real challenge here is to design systems where it is going to be economically feasible for the landowners to accept the water. So how are we going to get it out there? The preferred alternative that was selected in the study had two major components. Let me go back a little bit. That progress to date section, I don't know if you're doing the math there. But since 2005, we have about $106 million has been invested in this project out here. So it's we've been making progress. That's for sure. Okay. So there's two major components to the ARDWR program. This program was designed to maximize use of existing infrastructure. Let's use everything we have as much as possible to keep the cost down to the ultimate user, which is the individual landowners that have to repay all the costs. So we're going to expand East Slough Canal to its full capacity, and then we are going to design and build delivery systems, which are basically pipeline systems that are going to carry the water out to the lands. In the study, the hypothetical system that was developed by Reclamation to study this process, they estimated it was going to cost $75 million to do the East Slough Canal work, $750 million to do 8 pipeline distribution systems out there. Big pump stations, big pipes are going to take water 12 to 15 miles out to serve the existing deep well lands out there. So East District is taking this on. They're the ones that are doing the design work. They have geared up for this. They've hired a development coordinator, a couple of new engineers on the staff. They're doing the designs to move this forward. Ultimately, once the systems are in place that are acceptable to the landowners, they'll be able to enter into contracts with the landowners. The landowners saying, you know, we'll accept the water and be legally obligated to do that. That's the security to finance this. The district uses irrigation district authority to go to the local government or the municipal bond market, issue revenue bonds, and they'll build the systems and deliver the water. We hope to start to see water delivered sometime next year in some of the systems that are closer to the canal. So what have they been doing with the $26 million? This money came to East District in the fall of 2013, after the 13 legislative session, you know, that ran forever. So we're slow getting started. East District is using that $26 million, first of all, to expand East Slope Canal. And in the 2013-14 construction season, when the water's out of the canal, they managed to pull 1 million cubic yards of earth out of East Slope Canal and widen the first 13 miles of that canal. It's really something to watch the earth movers work out there. Other pieces that are associated with that portion of it are the design of new siphons. There are five additional siphons in the East Slope Canal portion of, or the remaining East Slope Canal. During the next construction season, the 14-15 construction season, that'll start in a little over a month, they will widen the last 30 miles of the canal. The district is close to issuing contracts for siphons and head gates to regulate the flow within the canal. So they're busy on doing that work. On the development side, they're working with landowners now. So you take the hypothetical you start with, and then you take it and move it into the real world, where you actually sit down with landowners that are eligible to participate in the program. You have to have a deep well permit that you can turn in effect, to ecology, put in standby, so that you're able to receive project water. The district, as they move this process forward, actually reduced the number of delivery systems. The hypothetical in the study had 8. Currently, the district has 6. And they have conducted several rounds of landowner meetings now, where they sit down with the landowners and have an in-depth discussion about delivery points, how much water they need, what the existing infrastructure is in the ground that the district didn't know about. You know, farmers out there with their deep well systems have lots of pipe in the ground. And the district, knowing that, can design delivery systems that can take advantage of the infrastructure that's already in place on the Department of Land, on the part of landowners, to keep the costs low. So the next part is refinement. So you look at the alternatives, you talk to the landowners, you get feedback from these folks, you assure that everyone who wants to participate is eligible. Department of Ecology reviews their water right and gives them a check off that says they can participate. And finally, everybody agrees in the numbers. The district develops a budget for construction. The landowners have a look at that. They look at their farm budgets, what they think they can afford. And if the decision is right, then the landowners sign a contract with the district, and the district is ready to go to the financial markets to implement the program. The other major, that's kind of it for the ARDWARP program. For the development program, it's active, it's underway, it's moving right along. The other major thing the district, or the Columbia Basin Development League, is really interested in right now is to return focus on the existing infrastructure. And that's important to anyone who lives in Central Washington and depends on the economy of this region. We need to keep the infrastructure strong, servicing the lands that are already in production, as well as try to grow it in the future. But if we don't maintain what we have, then we can have the potential for breakdowns in the future. Districts operate on a 100% reliability basis. Anything less than full water delivery 100% of the time is not acceptable. If you're a farmer out there and it's the 1st of August and it's 105 degrees and the district says, oh, gee, no, we're sorry, we're broke down today. We just can't get you water. And you can imagine the response to something like that. So that's not the standard we work towards. There's a lot of major infrastructure out there. Major reservoirs, Banks Lake is a reservoir. It didn't exist before the project was developed. Potholes. The pumping plant at Grand Coulee, the Keys pumping plant, is enormous. And it's 60 years old now. And stuff is starting to wear out. It needs to be replaced and kept up to date. There's 12 pumps in that pumping plant. 6 are pump generators that can be reversed and actually used by Reclamation and Bonneville to generate electricity. Each of those pumps is 65,000 horsepower apiece. They're amazing systems. 2,300 miles of canals, 4,000 miles of drains and wasteways, a tremendous number of pumping plants. You know, a lot of people in this region think the water all runs downhill. Well, folks, about 50% of water delivered on the Columbia Basin project is actually pumped water. All of it's pumped from FDR up to Banks Lake, but subsequently within the project, about half of it's pumped there. So there's 240 pumping plants throughout the project. The facilities are starting to show their age, and one of the things that we're seeking to do with regional decision makers like the Ofella City Council is just to bring this to your attention. The fact that we need to pay attention to this system, that we need to provide some focus and ongoing support to make sure it's maintained correctly. The facilities are showing their age. Columbia Basin Project relatively is a very young project compared to other reclamation projects in the West. And that's one thing that's allowed us to have some of the lowest water rates in the West. The other reclamation project in the state of Washington, the Yakima Basin Project, the water rates are about twice that as what they are here in the Columbia Basin Project for a reclamation project that's about 550,000 acres, another big reclamation project. On the left side of this picture, you see a panel that's broken there. And that panel was discovered early in the 2013 season, and it is just upstream from the picture in the right side of the photo, which is the main canal just below Billy Clapp Lake, or Pinto Dam, up by Soap Lake. It's just right around that corner there. For the major parts of this project, we have eyes, the districts have eyes on all the major structures every day. And this is the reason, because they're large structures and failure is not acceptable. So this is the panel that broke and was starting to be undermined that was on this major canal that serves the entire 686,000 acres. And can you imagine what would have happened if that canal failed the 1st of August at 105 degrees? This is a canal that flows up to 10,000 cubic feet per second. And at this particular point, this canal is perched on a hillside above a lake there on Crab Creek, way up in the hillside. So it would have washed out and it would have been a real ugly situation, but the districts kept track of that. District, the three irrigation districts operate the project in partnership with Reclamation, and they assumed responsibility for Project O&M in 1969. The federal government built the project, they capitalized it through congressional appropriations and they built it. Landowners repay it, although granted at an extremely favorable interest rate. But ongoing repair and operation and maintenance is the responsibility of the landowners. So if something breaks now, it's not the federal government that's fixing it, it's the landowners. And to give you an example of what we're starting to see now as the project is aging out, 10 years ago, the new manager at Quincy Columbia Basin Irrigation District, Darvin Fales, told me when he first started 10 years ago, his M&O maintenance budget was $300,000 a year. Last year it was $3 million. And that is applied against the 228,000 acres in the Quincy District. So each of the districts is looking at that type of thing, having to invest more and more to keep that infrastructure going. So we're down to the last quarter, actually. You know, people talk about the second half of the Columbia Basin project. I know I've lived in this region and worked in agriculture in the state for a long time. It was always the second half of the Columbia Basin project. Well, actually, once we get done building the ARGWARP and putting those 87,000 acres to work, we'll have closer to three quarters of the project done, closer to 750,000 acres. Projects authorized at 1,029,000 acres. We think it is the best investment that you'll find anywhere. It's drought resistant, even with the discussion of climate change. And I pay close attention to that issue because of my work with irrigation districts generally. All of the projections you see down the line indicate that, you know, things are going to change. But water supply in the Columbia Basin project really looks pretty good. We have the available land out here, out east of Othello here. There's a tremendous amount of really prime agricultural land that if you just add water would increase the economy in the city tremendously. We think that we can make the argument for food availability for national security. We don't want to get our food in China. We want to grow it here in the Columbia Basin project. It's going to take heavy lifting, though. It's going to take support from groups like the Othello City Council to move this project forward in the future. I'd be happy to answer any questions and really appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you. Is there questions, Council? I just have several. Is the reason Grant County's production is four times Adams County, is that because all of it, virtually all of its farmland is irrigated?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And actually, one of the interesting things is when you look at land in farms 2007 versus 2012, Grant County had a drop of 11%. They were at about 1,090,000 and went down to 900 and some thousand. And I would assume what it is way up in the northern part of Grant County, you probably had a lot of land that went out of production into CRP, that type of thing. The dry land portion of Grant County.
I know one of the issues you explained last time was the Columbia River Treaty with Canada.
Correct.
How is that progressing along?
It is still progressing. The actual anniversary date for the treaty was September 14th. That was the first date that either side, Canada or the U.S., could notify the other that it wanted to see changes in the city or in the treaty. The date came and passed, neither side notified the other they wanted to see changes. There's still a tremendous amount of activity going on around the treaty. The Native American community in both the U.S. and Canada is actively working to expand the scope of the treaty to include environmental concerns. You'll remember the original treaty only dealt with flood control and hydropower generation. So the Native American community wants to include environmental issues and fish restoration. This whole thing is going to work for a while. There's a lot of parties involved. There's a major conference that's sponsored by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council in Spokane, October 21st to 23rd. I'll be attending that, but they'll have all the sides, everybody telling their side of the story as it moves forward. State Department so far has it in a black box, and we're not seeing indications of what's likely to happen.
Mike, so this ARGWARP, as you described, the basic theory behind it then, as I understand from your presentation, is you're going to recharge the aquifer by not drawing any more water out of it.
Close. We're not going to recharge the aquifer, but we are. The intent is to stop drawing water out of it. Mm-hmm. The opportunity for recharge would be extremely slow, and the study did not, the environmental review did not look at the question of whether surface water supplies for lands that are currently deep well irrigated would have the effect of recharging groundwater. One of the things that we've seen in parts of the Columbia Basin project, the Black Sands area up there by Quincy and George, the area north of Pasco, are two areas where there are significant amounts of groundwater as a result of project operations, but it's shallow groundwater and it's not percolated to the really deep aquifers where most everybody now gets their drinking water and where the deep well irrigators get that land. So the intent is to take as many farms as possible, as much land as possible off that aquifer and reserve the remaining aquifer for municipal and industrial uses that can't use ditch water.
Okay.
Although, you know, maybe sometime in the future people will have a different view of using ditch water.
Maybe they will.
Yeah.
Okay. Council? Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming tonight.
Okay.
Moving on in our agenda, 4.3, Stan Anderton has an update on our scanning project.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. We have been moving forward, not as fast as some would like, and there are reasons for that. But we currently have all of the minutes of council meetings, resolutions, are on the council meetings, workshops, resolutions, and all of the audio recordings since we started with our new system are posted on the website. As we receive requests for old ones, those can be converted and added, but we didn't want to go back for something that nobody's looking for at this point. The contracts have substantially been completed and will be posted very soon. The next phase will be all of the agendas for the various meetings will be scanned and posted, and we're moving forward. Now, some might say, well, why don't we just hire someone to come in and speed that process up? And in our initial planning and thought processes, I think that our experience has proven what my original thought was, that the number one thing that slows us down is not the actual scanning process, but the preparation for that scanning. The getting the files, determining how we're going to implement that into our system takes the majority of the time. And you can't bring in somebody at $10 or $15 an hour and know what people with years of experience know in order to do that. The actual scanning goes very fast. The hardware and software we have seems to sit with a stack and just go ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. But it's going through, and all of that preparation is why it's taking that time. And then the posting doesn't take terribly long either, but it's that preparation to make sure that it's done right the first time.
Okay, so you talked about the minutes and the ordinances and the resolutions. What other, can you give the council an idea of what other documents after, you know, going forward, what you guys are going to do? Are we talking about doing emails? Are we talking about doing any of that type of information?
We have not had the formal discussion on emails.
Okay.
My personal thought, and like I say, we haven't been in those discussions, I think you're opening a can of worms. I think that it's best to leave those where they're at. Other people might feel differently, and I'm just somebody that implements what I'm told to do.
Right.
But I think that the actual documents that we have that are disclosable should be scanned, they should be available. It takes a tremendous amount of time to go through each individual email. And those aren't scanning. We have those. They're at least from 2009 forward when we put in the new email system. We have those, but each one of them has to be looked at by our records manager to determine whether it is disclosable. and the indexing of those and putting them out there would be just a horrendous time drain. So those that we have gone through already certainly would make it easier for the, if somebody made a similar request, we could pull upon those, the resources that we've already spent time on and quickly pull those out because they've already been reviewed.
So Stan, what other documents then are we looking at besides the emails?
I think that I'd have to defer that to Debbie. I'm the technical guy, but she's the records manager, and I'm not fully up to date on all of the things. I mean, we still have public works documents. We still have police department documents are very, very few that we can do as far as disclosable that we want to post. We may, and we do probably want to scan them, but we wanted to get those that we can post that are disclosable documents done first to kind of slow down the drain and make them available preemptively, if you will.
I think on our plate, there's not a lot of civil service that would be disposable because of testing results and test process. After we're done, we'll move forward into the finance department, the building department, public works department, and have them work on their records too. And during that time, we may have other clerks from home. We should probably get these scanned also and make them available.
Okay.
So we're almost done in our department, head builders and other departments soon.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, Stan. Does council, do you have any questions? Thank you for the update, Stan. Item 4.4, appointing Robert Blair to the Independent Salary Commission. Mayor, with confirmation by the City Council, shall appoint the members of the Independent Salary Commission. Socrates Hernandez was appointed by the committee. Are onto this committee. However, he recently moved out of town and he no longer meets the eligibility criteria to be on this commission. So Bob Blair has agreed to be appointed to the vacancy. This is a four-year term and it'll expire January 2018. And so I make the recommendation with consensus by the council to appoint Robert Blair to the Independent Salary Commission. Does everybody know any objection to Robert Blair? Mm-hmm. So we have a consensus. You guys are aware what the Independent Salary Commission does?
No.
They set the salaries of the elected officials.
Okay.
For the city. Moving on to item 4.5, establish the C penalty for ordinance and my understanding is, Catherine, you're going to highlight the last item on that ordinance we had adopted in September 8th. We didn't have a penalty in there. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank
you. A monetary penalty.
Correct. We need to have the council establish the specific C penalty that will be applied to the violations of your municipal code in general. So when you have a specific provision in your municipal code where you've identified a specific monetary penalty, that will prevail. In all other cases, this will be your default infraction monetary penalty.
Council, do you have any questions? Catherine?
I have a question. There was two penalties listed in there. One was $1,000 for the voluntary, and everything else was $250. What's the difference?
Well, for your penalties, by law, the council can authorize up to $5,000 in a monetary penalty per violation. Beyond that, you can identify lower specific penalties for specific violations, or you can establish a general default penalty amount so that you don't have to go through your entire code and specifically identify for each violation. So the $1,000, for instance, would be discretionary with the council. If you want to change that amount, that's at the council's discretion. If you want to increase that to the maximum penalty of $5,000, that's at the council's discretion. Typically, what my clients have done is they have reserved the $5,000 maximum statutory penalty for the most egregious violations. For instance, illicit discharges into your stormwater system, for instance. And then for the lesser infractions, they'll establish a default C penalty that is applied unless there is a specific alternate penalty provided for. The state statute, by comparison, the default penalty for civil infractions is $250. In looking at your C penalty schedule, the closest I think you have is a C penalty of $260. So that might be something to consider for your default amount. And keep in mind, when that penalty is imposed, the court has to impose the assessments, which I believe are 90% of the underlying fine. So it actually almost doubles the penalty by the time it's all said and done.
Any other questions? Catherine, could you please advise us on a motion to adopt a C penalty?
The motion would be to approve the adoption of a C, whatever that number is, penalty to be inserted in Chapter 1.30.030.
This time I entertain a motion to do so.
Now, the number she's referring to, she wants to put in the monetary amount? Mm-hmm.
The $260.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
I'll make that motion for $260.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion made and seconded. Is there any discussion or further information?
C7.
C7. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Next item on our agenda is 4.6, right-of-way permit discussion. Wade, there were some changes to that the council needs to consider, and Wade has the pros and cons for us tonight, right?
Yes. Council members, several weeks back, we had the citizen complain about having to purchase a right-of-way permit for deliveries by Home Depot. The reason that we charged the right-of-way permit, because we have a complaint from someone else that they were delivering household appliances with an 18-wheeler and a forklift, which was obstructing the roadway, and the forklift was working in our roadway. So by definition, by the appropriate OMC, which is, I think you have in front of you there, then we are supposed to, whenever work is done on the right-of-way, we're supposed to get a permit for it. So I researched that, talked to Home Depot several times to see that indeed the way they've been delivering. They claim they've been delivering this way for 4 years, but nobody in the city can remember seeing that, so that's neither here nor there at this point. And I asked them why they were doing it this way, and they said because they usually tag it onto other deliveries in the area from Moses Lake, and that way it's the last thing on the truck, or the first thing on the truck they're going to take off. And so they don't have to go back and forth. I said, okay. I would not talk him off of trying to get another delivery vehicle, but he says, that's the company you use, that's what they're going to have. So now we're stuck with having our citizens pay for the right-of-way permit unless we change the OMC. So I researched that, talked to Public Works, and said, we can do this, but Terry, in his capacity as enforcing the OMCs and also ensuring that we're doing the right thing for safety and otherwise, I had to put a point paper together to say why we shouldn't do an exception or exemption to the OMC. He came up with four reasons. One was public safety, and he says the concern here is a piece of large equipment can do a lot of damage to a small child, pedestrian, or car driving through the area that should be coned off to identify it as a work zone. The city needs to be assured the contractor is insured and they are using safety measures while working inside the city limits. That was the first concern. Second is we've had experience here with water meter boxes and lids, roads, curbs, and sidewalks being damaged by heavy equipment. And in those instances, when we had the right-of-way permit, we knew who had done it because they were working in the area. The third thing was private party damages. Large equipment can easily damage a car or property, whatever, and this way we know who's been in the area working. And the second is, if we allow this, perhaps they're not licensed. The equipment used by contractors is not licensed to be used on city streets. A right-of-way permit allows them the temporary use of the city streets for delivery of their goods. So that, those are the arguments against doing that, and I wanted to make sure we saw both sides of this. Obviously, the argument for doing an exemption to the RC, to the OMC is our citizens having to pay $40 every time they get a refrigerator or stove delivered. What we proposed for your consideration, two courses of action. One is to leave the OMC as it is, have our citizens, they can come and buy something from Home Depot, come in and purchase a right-of-way permit, they have a stove or refrigerator or something delivered. The other course of action is to do an exemption to the OMC 11.50 that would allow delivery of home appliances only with a 30-minute limit in the street for any, basically any vehicle that's delivered. So that's what I propose to you all today, to either make a motion to leave it as it is or to pass an exemption to the OMC. This is, I think, important up here. Right here at the bottom, form of motion. An ordinance amending the Federal Municipal Code, Chapter 11.50, child right-of-way permits, or continuing to enforce ordinance. So it would be a motion to pass an exemption to the OMC.
Wade, is that exemption the only change to the ordinance?
That would be the only change to the ordinance.
And Catherine, have you reviewed the change?
We have not, had this discussion yet. She was out of town last week, so.
Okay.
I have reviewed the change. I would just throw out one, a third option, having listened to Wade give his presentation, and that is you could consider granting a fee exemption using the language that's been proposed, but just calling it a fee exemption so that they don't have to pay the permit fee and yet the other conditions of the permit in terms of having insurance, putting up cones if cones are necessary or barriers would still be applicable, which might provide a little more protection from a liability standpoint.
So still, just to make sure we got a fee exemption in that they won't have to pay the fee, but they still have to get the permit.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds really good. They've got to have some sort of notification to the city that they're going to be making a delivery if they're going to be blocking the streets.
I like that option.
So
that's up to you guys. So.
If you wanted to take action on it tonight, I would propose that you just insert before exemptions on the title of the new section fee exemptions, and then in the first sentence say a right-of-way permit fee as provided for in this chapter shall not be required in the following.
And for delivery of appliances and with a...
Okay, so... Or you want to limit, the council want to limit it to appliances only, or do you want to?
I would limit it to the delivery of, you know, from the stores such as Home Depot, because I haven't heard of the right-of-way permit being a problem with anything else.
Yeah, it's not. It's just been these appliance, as far as I know, appliance deliveries.
I wouldn't recommend the exemption for anything else, but for the appliance.
It would make me a little nervous though with, like Lowe's coming in and unloading some rafters.
They would have to get a regular right-of-way permit. Oh,
yeah.
That's what we're saying, it's just for appliances.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for just delivery appliances. For delivery of just appliances to customers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, and obviously...
customer deliveries, or right. Instead of just delivery of that makes sense.
Yeah, just well. Yeah, customer deliveries in the residential area.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty specific.
Yeah.
In residential areas.
So what happens?
Appliances.
Huh?
Yeah.
Only appliances.
Appliances. Yeah.
Appliances.
So what happens if Ziggy's comes down with a load of trusses, and he's going to be sitting there for an hour?
He
gets a permit.
He has to get a permit.
They need to be aware of that.
Yeah, and the contractor will know that. Yeah, the contractor's in town that. I mean,
this is like a home delivery service.
Yeah.
It's like.
Well, and that's what you could put, make it is a home delivery. of appliances and such.
Okay, so I think maybe before we adopt anything, it's kind of, let's fine-tune our language.
Yeah, I think so.
What do you guys think?
Get it wrote up so that we know what we're putting our motion towards.
Based on what she said, I'll zip that, I guess, in October.
Okay.
To the meeting there, and I'll make sure, get with Catherine, write the wording correctly with that new option to not charge a fee, which is...
Exemption.
That'll make Terry feel better.
Yes.
And
I like Catherine's idea, too. Yes.
Well, before Catherine made the, I completely agree with Terry. You can't just let them come in and block off the roads and not compensate the people who are not going to be able to use those roads.
Okay. Got it.
Got it. Thank you. Wait. Moving on in our agenda, item 4.7, ordinance creating OMC chapter 9.46 titled Off-Road Vehicles and Wheeled All-Terrain Vehicles. Before us, we have an ordinance that would, in essence, allow use of street-legal four-wheelers and off-road vehicles to be driven on city streets. So, Wayne?
Yeah. As council remembers, we had a request from citizen Rob Simmons to come up with an ordinance, or at least allow off-road vehicles to be used in the city. He wants to commute back and forth through the work zone, which is great. So, Catherine actually researched this a bit, and so did Rob Simmons, and found several communities in Washington State who had piggybacked on the RCW, which was passed a while back. And so I pulled those out and found one that closely resembled our size community, and cut and pasted a lot from there, then tailored it to fit our community as far as speed limits and roads and that sort of thing. And that what you, you know, sent that to you guys, or put it on board docs and asked for inputs. Got a couple of inputs, which I incorporated some of those into the proposed OMC. And basically, again, we're going pretty much along the lines with RCW. Catherine has one addition as we work through this, but some of the things we looked at was local speed limits here in Othello. You know, we have almost no roads except for one part of Highway 24, which is anything more than 35 miles an hour. It's 45 miles an hour down the other side of Highway 26, obviously. But the purpose of this is not to allow ORV off-road vehicles to go that fast in that part of our city, because we don't want to interfere with traffic. That's pretty much industrial down there. So what was said in this ordinance is that we'll limit them to no more than 30 miles an hour, regardless of what, even if on a 35 mile per hour street, they should stay at 30. And there's some exceptions in there. Some other things that we're putting there is a flag or a pole with a flag on it. I know that Eugene wanted to discuss that a little bit. And there's some other things in there that are specific to Othello, but not a whole lot. A lot of it mirrors most of what's out there already in the RCWs. So with that, I'll stop talking and allow you guys to discuss it.
Eugene, you had some questions?
One of my questions, which Catherine already explained about, like, being able to drive on Broadway, you know, because it's 35 miles an hour and they got in there 30. So you can drive on it, but you just can't go over 30 miles an hour, is what she explained to me, so that was fine. The flags, I don't really see a necessity on the flags. They're used out at the dunes for the specific reason of if you're coming over steep curves, steep hills, that you can be seen on the other side. We don't have any dune cliff type of stuff anywhere in town. And most ATVs, or some motorcycles that ain't any taller than a decent size ATV. You know, so I, you know, me personally, I don't see the necessity in the flags. It's a good way of getting smacked in the back of the head by a flag. So, but anyway.
Thank you. Eugene, anyone else?
Well, I can see where the flag would help with visibility of, you know, because unfortunately, being in a car, you don't notice the motorcycles as much and the ATVs as much, just being a devil's advocate. And I can see where that would help with visibility, but he's correct. We don't have any big curves or big hills or anything like that, so I either way.
Okay.
I don't think they're needed.
Angel?
You're going to have lighting in back, single lights, you know, signals for each side and your headlights and everything, because I read the headlights have to be on. Well, that's in the front, of course, but I don't think they're needed. That's like Eugene said, it's mainly for the dunes, you know, when you're on the other side of the hill.
So we got two against the flag so far.
I mean, the flags. It's just something that's going to fly out there 8 feet behind you. Mm-hmm. And.
Okay. John? Comment? Okay.
Why 21?
Yeah, that was my other one.
Councilmember Hu asked for it to be 21. I'm sorry, Councilmember Hu, you asked that. So I put that, again, this is still up for discussion. We can change that to 18.
Yeah. Okay?
Well, so. I can see where you want to eliminate the joyriding of the teenagers. And if we're looking at this to allow people to ride to work.
I would think 18, in my opinion. That's my opinion, but then I'm.
I see.
Two at 18. Court, you're 18.
Yep. I actually kind of thought 16, but.
16, you got a driver's license, you might as well drive. If you're driving on the street, whether it's in a souped up four wheel drive pickup that could roll over somebody, or you're in an ATV. What difference?
I'm with you, John. I mean,
you gotta learn responsibility sometime, so. If you have a valid driver's license and you're 16 years old, drive. I mean.
Yeah, but I can also see where the ATVs have been recreational for years and years and years, and it'd be too tempting to go out there and just goof around.
It's not like
that's
a car.
That's a parent's decision regarding their children.
On this here, you can get a ticket just like in a car. As soon as we pass this, you can get a ticket just like a car. That's correct.
I think I'd like to hear from our police chief if he has any comments at this time. If you don't, that's fine, Phil.
And Catherine can join in on some of these places. 16 and above, we can write that ticket. 18 and above, 18 is where people can be held civilly liable. So if there wasn't an insurance and they got in a crash, someone could sue them, but under 18, they can't be sued. So that may be a consideration.
I think 18 would be the way to go then.
Then who would the liability lie with? Would it lie with the parents of the individual underage?
If they had insurance.
Okay. Well, they need to have insurance if they're going to be driving on the street.
That's actually not required by the state statute for the wheeled all-terrain vehicles. That's something that we've added to your proposed ordinance.
That they carry insurance?
Yes.
Yes.
Show proof of insurance.
It may actually be difficult to get because this is very new territory, so I don't know how.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
To get insurance on a four-wheeler?
To drive on a public city street.
Oh,
we won't know whether somebody has the insurance, even if you adopt this ordinance, until and unless there's an accident, right, or a citation issued, because there's no part of the licensing and registration at the state level that requires proof of insurance for the ATVs, like there is for a regular vehicle or a motorcycle.
We can require it. Yes.
It's just that there's really no mechanism for us proactively to make sure that people are insured until they're stopped.
And we have a very high rate of uninsured motorists already in our community.
Yeah.
You can't get it insured per se, but what are the liabilities going to be, you know, for like your comp, for your, you know, that's another thing.
Minimum limit.
Yeah.
The way this was worded was state minimum limits, which would be the same as a vehicle.
Yeah.
A car.
I think 18 makes more sense to go with in this case, because if we allowed it for 16-year-olds and they went out there and they weren't insured and the parents weren't insured, then that car owner, property owner, whoever is going to come back to us and go, why in the heck did you do this?
I could see that happening.
Yeah.
I agree with the 18.
Gentlemen and ladies, 18. Gina's going with 18.
At the very least.
Corey's an 18.
Yes, 18.
John?
18. Sorry.
Just okay, 18.
Go 18.
Just for the civil infraction part of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So far we're going to do away with the flags.
We're going to do away with the flag.
Change it to 18.
We're going to lower it to 18.
Okay. And then Catherine had one more thing to add as well. suggested.
In section 090 on violation and penalties, I would propose that you add a sentence at the end of that paragraph that states, any violation of this ordinance not covered by the RCWs will be considered a violation of the Othello Municipal Code, which will be an infraction with a C blank penalty as set forth in OMC Chapter 1.10, so that anything we've added, like the age requirement, that's not a violation of state law, but it would be a violation of our ordinance, then you've set a specific penalty. Because otherwise, if we don't set a specific penalty, when they get issued the infraction, the judge can suspend or defer the fine, and we don't want the judge to have that authority. So I would like you to add that sentence so that you've established a C penalty specific to these violations.
And this is 9.46090?
Yeah.
Yes.
Add that. Okay.
With that, I would ask if there are any other additions or deletions you guys would like to have.
Can I throw out 35 miles an hour instead of 30?
Well, the idea there was that people normally go 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit anyway, so we kept it at 30. This is an input from when you all, I can remember, that was, you know.
How do your radar guns work on those things?
They won't.
Oh, yeah. They don't work. So I hear. In Idaho.
So,
what me personally,
several changes now to this ordinance. We're going to drop the requirement for a flag. We're going to drop the age limit from 21 to 18, and we're going to add the penalty section on 9.46090, which would include a C7 violation of $260.
One other thing, who's going to do the vehicle inspections to license these things?
Well,
they're going to be required to have.
It's just going to be the. That, I mean, your regular registration is not going to be an inspection, is there?
Yeah, they have to do that in order to register it as a wheeled all-terrain vehicle with the state, and there are specific statutory provisions on what those people can charge. So it's whomever they can find that's qualified to do the inspection, and those people can only charge up to, I think, $40 or $50.
In a state patrol, I think.
Okay.
So they have to meet all the criteria we've put in.
The state criteria, basically, is what we're adopting.
Yeah, well, the J item, brakes in working order, isn't got RCW behind it. It's
where are you at? 9.
There's a comma, though, in the RCW's
after 8. We have to inspect it.
But everything that's required here of the vehicle is on the RCW, so it's a state registration, and we get it.
46.090.
The only thing I added, John, was that flag thing, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Equipment. And you get, we'll take that off, so.
I just didn't see anything neat. Okay. Item J.
Something separate from the state now. Okay. So.
Would it be my understanding if this ordinance is adopted tonight? Tomorrow morning, people could be driving on the street.
5 days.
5 days.
Plus you have
5 days.
Plus you have to take it and have that inspection done that she just showed me too.
Okay.
Now, when they have the inspection done, is there some kind of certificate they get so that if
yes,
the police want to pull them over, they have to show that they've been inspected?
Yes, and that's done through DOL. We're not in charge of that inspection or issuing those stickers, but that will be done through DOL. Mm-hmm.
Department of Licensing, you get a tab just like on the car, huh?
Yes, Deb.
$260.
Make it a C7. Well, I believe that's what we said.
She just said C something or other.
C7.
She didn't specifically
C7.
Say
she looked it up, yeah.
An item.
And it was on there.
Okay.
Okay, Council, thank you very much, Wade.
Other additions? Okay, so Catherine can work toward the motion, pretty much with the exceptions that we just talks about chimneys.
Would you give us that?
So, it would be a motion to approve the new chapter 9.46 of the municipal code with the change in age limit to 18, the deletion of paragraph M in section 040, and the addition of the sentence to the violation penalty section .090.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Any discussion? Further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much, Catherine. The next item on our agenda is unfinished business. Unfinished business is something that the council, if there was something that we had talked about previously and there had been no conclusion or resolution to that matter, that's when the council will bring up those issues. New business. Is there any unfinished business come before the council? Item six, new business. That's where you bring up a new item not previously discussed that the council would like brought up at our next meeting. And that also would probably give administration or staff time to research. So then we would discuss that at our next meeting. That's in our rules, council rules of conduct. Is there any new business to come before council tonight? Hearing none, we'll move to item 7.1, executive session real estate. Anticipate 15 minutes.
Mayor, sorry.
Yes.
One question on unfinished business. The council like an update on the well. I forgot to add that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. My bad. Should I get an update?
Sure.
Okay. Just take me 2 minutes. As you know, we went down to 1,100 feet. We made a determination at that point to plug the well back up to 1,040 feet and sure we didn't interfere with the Grand Rhine with the option. Obviously, we wanted to go a bit deeper later on, we could. At that point, once we got the plug in place, they pump tested it week before last. They did a step test up to about 2,000-something gallons per minute. And then, 2,300 gallons per minute, went stepped up to that. Then they did the constant rate test for 3 days at about 1,480 gallons per minute. All those tests went well. We made the determination that we could probably get somewhere between 1,300 and 1,500 gallons per minute out of it on a constant rate basis. They went back in and did another camera look at the hole, found that there was a leak in their plug. They're going back in, probably started this afternoon, to plug that leak. It's still within our budget to do that. I asked that question. They didn't spend as much out of our budget for the plug as we did plan. They plugged that, they go back in, camera it again, make sure there's no more leakage. The concern of the leak was the water was running down into the Grand Rhine. And they were pretty sure that DOE would not like that. So that's why they plugged it. They'll go back in, redo the plug. We're going to put a screen slash sleeve in there to help make sure we don't collapse anything when we start pumping. They'll do that. At that point, you know, we can start thinking about putting the pump down and doing the pipes. So that's where we are. Looks pretty good.
Fluoride's still good?
Well, fluorides were good. Yeah. That was probably the big surprise of this whole thing. Fluorides were never an issue.
Excellent. I didn't think they would be.
Excellent.
Yeah. So we're doing pretty good. We think we're going to put a VFD, a variable frequency, something on there. It's going to help people pump more or pump less depending on the head level or the static water level. So we may be able to get more than 1,500.
So you're going to use a transducer with a VFD to regulate the flow.
Yeah. Yes.
Excellent.
Yep.
Much better than well number 8 with that autoclave valve. In fact, they should update well number 8.
We're talking about doing that too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent.
Yes. Are we going to, in the meantime, now begin to go through the process to secure water rights to drill into the Grand Rhine aquifer?
We can do that. We haven't thought about that. What I thought we were going to do first, Mayor, is to get with Tim Flint. I've reached out to him. He needs some more data from us, which I'm going to provide in the next couple of days. And then we'll meet with him, the consultant we hired, that you're using. And we're going to come up with a plan based on what we have, based on what we think we can do. He's going to, I'm providing the data we got from the Grama folks, from Paul Stoker. He's going to compare all that, and we're going to come up with a plan. At that point, we may decide to do that. Before we spend any more money, anything else, I believe you guys want to make sure we have a really good way forward. And so that's what we're going to do.
But eventually, I mean, you don't have to do that right away. Eventually, you could at some point down the road, do that with either that well or another well that you have within the system in LaFell.
The ability to drill into the groundwater.
Right, and, you know, if you were really going to, if you're thinking about a well to do that in, would be well number six, which was already a grand well, Ron well, in the first place.
Those are the kind of things we look at with Jim Flynn and his folks.
Yes.
To ask those questions and see what the best way forward is.
Yeah. That's great, you're getting that kind of volume. That's really good.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, very good. Thank you, Wade.
Just something on the unfinished business that, did you, were you able to get a hold of the East District or the South District about those fencing issues?
No, not yet.
Okay.
No, I need the name to tell to, so.
At the South District? I don't know, but Craig was here. He's with the East District, and
he'd
be able to tell you.
Craig Simpson.
Yeah, Craig Simpson would be able to tell you who to get a hold of.
Yeah.
But that is something. I mean, that canal runs right down our city, in you know, and we have to divert around it, you know, at the corner up there on 14th. So it is something they need to take care of. It's in bad shape.
Huh? Buried.
Yeah.
Yeah. Move it back farther.
Okay.
Thank you. This time I'd like to go into executive session to discuss potential real estate purchase. I anticipate 15 minutes and no decision will be made following. So with that, I'd like to have Wade, Catherine, to remain, and then the rest of the staff.
Yep.
Okay, we've come now out of executive session, and I'd like to move on to agenda item 8. Council will also receive 8.1 department heads August reports. And having no further business to come before the council, I'd like to adjourn the meeting.